so don't waste any time. No, I don't think I'll retire. Ship captain suits me.
This is Danny Glover, and you're listening to 88.3 FM WRCT Pittsburgh.
Let's talk about something we've discussed kind of anecdotally before, but not big picture. The TSA says that they have confiscated a record number of firearms from airline passengers at airports this year. And you might be shocked to know that only some of those confiscated firearms belonged to Republican Congressman Madison Cawthorn. So only a partial joke there. He actually did get caught trying to bring a firearm on board, trying to get it through security just a few months ago. Let's discuss the data. Passengers are bringing a record number of guns to the airport, TSA says. Airline passengers are bringing guns to the airport in numbers never seen before, and it is a, quote, huge problem. Security and law enforcement officials are at the same time dealing with an unprecedented surge in belligerent passengers straining the systems designed to keep air travel safe. We've had more incidences where, don't they mean incidents? We've had many more incidences where there are passenger disturbances both in checkpoints and onboard aircraft. That makes it more important that there are no guns involved, says TSA Administrator David Pekoski. TSA reports catching 4,650 firearms at checkpoints in the first 10 months of the year, a majority of which were loaded, folks, loaded firearms in airports. That surpasses the full year record of 4,432 from 2019. So we've still got the rest of October, as well as November and December, and we're already several hundred firearms beyond the record. With 11 weeks left in the year, including the busy Thanksgiving and Christmas seasons, the number will reflect an American population that is increasingly armed. I think more people are carrying weapons just generally across the country, and then whatever is happening across the country, we see reflected in our checkpoints. As a passenger, I don't want another passenger flying with me with a gun in their possession. Yeah. The agency is also finding guns at a faster rate than it has ever experienced. During the lows of air travel, during the pandemic in 2020, transportation security officers confiscated a gun from about 10 passengers every 1 million. This year, they're finding 11 armed passengers in every 1 million. 80% of the firearms were found loaded. No checkpoint No airport is immune from having passengers try to carry guns through the checkpoint. It does occur more frequently in, again, the states where gun carriage is at a higher rate compared to other states. You know, there are people who react to these stories. And in fact, Republican Congressman Madison Cawthorn said exactly this when he was caught. The explanation was, the justification was, it was an honest mistake. I didn't realize that the gun was in my carry-on. That is negligent action. If you don't know, what are the main things about firearms? Keep them unloaded. Keep them safely stored and know where they are. If you believe your gun is unloaded at home or unloaded in your checked baggage and it's actually loaded in your carry-on, that is negligence and you shouldn't even have that firearm. The justification, the excuse that they use is actually something for which they should have the ability to have that firearm removed. If you can't keep track of where your loaded firearms are, you don't have any business owning a gun. Aside from anybody's views about the Second Amendment or background checks or whatever, when you say, oops, I didn't think the gun was in my carry-on, then you didn't know where it was. And that's negligence and it's irresponsible gun ownership. Not knowing where your gun is. And it's a frequently used excuse. But it's not really an excuse. It should actually make us say, whoa, we've got to look into that more. The article goes on to say, firearm fines by TSA workers create an inconvenience for flyers during a time when more people are looking to travel again. Yeah, it's more than an inconvenience. It's actually a sort of an existential threat. Firearms 80% loaded. Gun discovery, slow checkpoint lines trigger a local or airport police response. Airline officials, meanwhile, are asking airport police to be proactive about spotting intoxicated or otherwise agitated passengers who may spark an in-flight disturbance. Yeah, we've talked about this as well. Those unruly passengers are also at previously unseen levels. It's sort of like a pandemic-induced psychosis that we're seeing. It's wild what is happening at airports. How many times have I flown during the pandemic? I guess three round-trip flights. And all of the stuff I saw at the U.S. airports, part of it was at international airports. Everything I saw at U.S. airports, there was wacky behavior. And this is, by the way, beyond just people playing fast and loose with the mask rules, like holding a glass the entire flight to be in the process of drinking and keeping their mask down, you know, stuff like that. I'm talking about just belligerent people, drunk people, loud people screaming. It's not good. It's not good what's going on. And certainly adding firearms to that mix would only make it much, much worse. I want to play a clip for you today of a Fox News guest sort of giving away the game, giving away the strategy when it comes to the anti-mask protests. There's this guy, David Avella, who's the chairman of GOPAC, G-O-P, Pack, go pack. Yeah, okay. He was a guest on Fox News, and he essentially admits to what these wild protests are at school board meetings, what they're really designed to do, and why they're being urged on by right-wing media and right-wing activists and strategists. They want to make public school seem so chaotic that parents will say, I'm pulling my kid out. I'm going to send them to a private school. I'm going to send them to a charter school. It's similar to the strategy around making the Postal Service really not function properly. We'll get to that. Let's start with the clip. Take a listen to this.
Julie brought to this conversation makes me think maybe she'll run for school board and we need somebody like...
I can barely be a clown.
So right now they're praising some outrageous lunatic woman who was screaming her mouth, you know, screaming her head off at a school board meeting.
Teacher, so I don't know about that. I actually elected to be the class teacher to my sixth grader and I don't know what I was thinking.
Look, this is going to be a boom for private schools, for charter schools,
right,
for homeschoolers,
yep,
who are going to look for an alternative other than in the public school. And there are plenty of wonderful organizations out there that provide scholarships for kids to go to charter schools. And
by the way, it's entirely an apparatus that takes money away from public schools as well.
what we're going to start seeing is, once again, Democratic politicians' policies are going to hurt the very people they think they are going to help, which is in many of our poor and rural communities all across this country. And to Jenna's point, you ask most everyday teachers, they want to teach their kids the basics, reading, writing, arithmetic, so that they're ready to go out and compete in a world where China is not teaching the agenda.
Yeah, there's actually a question mark as to whether the standard curriculum is actually preparing our kids. That different question. But he's saying the quiet part out loud here. He's saying the quiet part. This has been the Republican agenda. This has been the DeSantis agenda for a long time in Florida as well. Weaken public schools in favor of corporate-owned schools, charter schools, private schools, etc. And one way to do it is creating requirements that make the schools look bad, either through testing, standardized testing, different things, to then say the school's not working, let's take money away, let's give vouchers to people who want to send their kids to a private or a charter school instead. So you make the schools worse to then justify making them even worse. This is a very, it's like a perfect opportunity. Make it seem crazy. Parents hear, oh my God, there's anti-mask protesters outside of the school when my kids are showing up, and then there's anti-mask protesters taking over the school board. This is too crazy. I'm going to send my kids to a charter school, to a private school. I'm going to homeschool them. Remember, something like 70% of American homeschooling is Christian-based and for religious and moral reasons. Mission accomplished. This is exactly the plan. And the bigger picture here is privatization. That's the bigger picture. Destroy. Why do they want to make the Postal Service function like crap? Because then you can justify eliminating it altogether and saying, let's just let actual private industry, even though the Postal Service is an independent enterprise under the purview of the federal government, they don't want the government doing stuff, right? That's socialism. When the government does stuff, it's socialism, even if it's just oversight of an independent Postal Service. So then people go FedEx, they go UPS, DHL, etc. Damage the Postal Service to justify private replacements, damage public schools to justify sending more money to private schools and charter schools, et cetera. And they now are making these anti-mask protesters out to be martyrs or victims or whatever the case may be. And let's just look at one clip of that real quick. This is also during the same program, Kennedy saying, you're going to be targeted for passionately raising your voice.
We need to focus on the basics. And that's not what's happening right now.
Can I add something very quickly, Emily?
Of course.
You're more likely to be targeted and charged by the FBI for raising your voice passionately at a school board meeting than you are for trying to set a federal building on fire with people inside in Portland, Oregon.
Right. They're basically saying just protesting about masks is more likely to get you treated harshly by law enforcement than Antifa setting fires in Portland, Oregon. That's the case that they want to make. The game here is privatization. David Avella there saying the quiet part out loud. We know what they're doing. And also it's the moralizing and the engaging people with the most controversial stuff they can. And right now masking and vaccination is exactly what that is. They're admitting it. They're telling us that that's why they're doing it. Tuesday, October 19th, 6 p.m. Eastern time will be our live viewer town hall. It'll be streaming only on the second YouTube channel, Pacman Live, at youtube.com/Pacman Live. Everybody will be allowed to call in. Members will get priority, but it'll be wide open to everybody. I hope you'll join us. Remember that the David Pacman Show does depend on the few of you, comparatively speaking, who get a membership at joinpacman.com. You can sign up, become a member, support the show, and of course, get instant access to the daily bonus show for members only. Sign up at joinpacman.com. Let's speak to some people from the audience. We now take calls via Discord at davidpacman.com/Discord. You can use Discord to chat with other viewers and listeners and also to talk to me. All right. Let's start today with Tyler from St. Louis. Tyler from St. Louis, you were on the air.
Hey, what's up?
How you doing?
I'm doing good.
Good.
So
the question I want to ask is, what is the path here going forward for like the Progressive Caucus? Because in many ways, I feel like, you know, burn it all down, everything like that. But then the other thing is, it's like, how long can they keep it up before it starts hurting us?
Before what starts hurting us?
Oh, the infrastructure deal.
You're saying it not being passed?
Yeah.
Oh. Yeah, I mean, listen, I think there are some people within the Progressive Caucus who really are like burn it down type accelerationists. I don't think the Progressive Caucus in general is going to ultimately say no deal if it's not a perfect deal. I think the Progressive Caucus overall understands you really can't let the perfect be the enemy of the better than what we have. And I think ultimately, if it doesn't happen, it's really going to be because of Republicans. But you're thinking that it might be the Progressive Caucus that actually prevents infrastructure from being done?
No, it's just kind of like how I personally feel about it. Like, I'm like split, you know. I mean, I understand compromise and everything like that.
Yeah,
but the thing is, you know, the deal's being broken.
Tyler, are you eating something while you talk to me?
Yeah, sorry about that.
You are. What are you eating out of curiosity?
Just a sandwich.
Sandwich. Okay. All right, good. Okay, listen, Tyler, I understand your concern. I don't think progressives are ultimately going to be the roadblock for the infrastructure bill.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah. All right, I'm going to let you go. Your Discord's blinging now. Lots going on over there. I'm going to let you get back to the sandwich, which seems delicious, quite frankly. Why don't we go next to... Oh, I don't know. It's so hard to know where to go. What about Sam from New York City?
Hey, how you doing? I just wanted to ask, I know in the past, I don't know if it was a year or two ago, maybe you had Stephanie Kelton on. I was just wondering if, you know, with maybe some of the recent stimulus packages, you've reconsidered your feelings towards MMT or just sort of what your general sense is towards modern monetary theory?
Yeah, my general, so we've interviewed Stephanie a couple of times. My general perspective on modern monetary theory right now is that modern monetary theory makes a few important points that should be considered. One, a government and country's budget is not analogous to a household budget. It's not, and so we have to use different terms. The analogies and the comparisons to a household budget don't make sense because households can't change the money supply. That's number one. Number two, modern monetary theory makes a fantastic point, which is known outside of MMT as well, that different types of deficit spending are differently stimulative depending on what you're spending the money on. That's the second important thing. Beyond that, I'm not yet of the mindset that the government can do absolutely anything to the money supply with no impact whatsoever. I don't think that's what modern monetary theory is saying, but there are people who think that that's what it's saying, and I think that has not at all been demonstrated. So that's kind of where I am on MMT right now.
Yeah, that's fair, and I think I agree with you. I don't think real people who have studied modern monetary theory would say it's just about spending as much as you want without consequences. It's basically like, I guess my understanding is you can spend as long as the resources are there, as long as the physical and human infrastructure is there to take on whatever spending, then you can pretty much spend as much as you want because you won't have excess money chasing scarcity of goods or resources as long as you have enough resources. I guess my problem is, I mean, I just read Stephanie Kelton's book and still don't think I have a firm understanding of MMT. And so I wonder, like, I just think politically, you know, not that we're anywhere close to Democrats promoting modern monetary theory, really, but I think there is so much promise in it, but it would take a complete restructuring of the framework of how we discuss deficits.
Oh, yeah. And remember that the debt and deficit political football is one that both Republicans and Democrats toss around to different degrees. It's the Republicans who claim to care about the deficit and then blow it up. Like, it's not a both sides thing in that sense. But both parties still benefit from a lot of the discourse around debt and deficit. And that makes it hard to break the fact that that's how they're operating.
Yeah. One thing I've thought about is, you know, states don't have the same freedom to deficit spend because they're not producing their own currency. But if they could produce their own sort of currency, I wonder if progressive states, I don't think this is constitutional, but I think it'd be an interesting experiment if, let's say, California created its own sort of currency, could then deficit spend, implement some of the policies of MMT, and be able to fund pretty substantial government projects.
Yeah, that's seeming a little out there and unlikely as far as I'm concerned
Yeah.
No, it's an interesting idea. All right, my friend, thank you for the call. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
All right. DavidPakman.com/discord is how you can jump in and talk to me. Let's speak next to Gio from Juarez.
Hello, David.
Yes.
Hey, I'm from Mexico, and I also wanted to elaborate from the last time Eric from Cancun called about the El Paso shooting. And how I'm also a bit worried about what could happen if I go to the U.S.
Okay.
You see, I'm from Juarez. I'm from the border of Mexico. And it's really worrying to me sometimes because I used to travel a lot to the U.S. before the pandemic. Actually, the international bridges have been closed since March 2020, and they will open for the first time in November this year, supposedly. So I am also a bit worried about if I should be worried for a shooting or something.
Okay. Well, I mean, listen, it's just about your personal risk assessment. I would research where you're going and determine whether it's suitable for your level of risk. I mean, I can't possibly answer the question, is it safe for you to go to the U.S., you know?
Yeah, because, you know, you see the shooting that happened in El Paso in the Walmart is actually a Walmart me and my mother used to go a lot. Mm. And actually, we didn't plan to go on the day that it happened, but a friend was there, a friend of mine, he's safe, he didn't suffer anything, but he just got a little PTSD and is scared of loud noises. I don't know if that's still the case, but yeah, it's a bit worrying. Just wanted to share that.
Yeah, I mean, listen, the odds of you being killed in a shooting are very, very low, although still higher than in many other countries, right? So you know, it's a very personal decision.
Okay, well, I just wanted to ask your opinion on that.
Yeah, I can't possibly advise you on that.
I see.
All right, my friend, thank you very much for the call. Let's go next to Hunter from Colorado. Hunter, you're on the air.
Hey, David, how you doing?
I'm doing well, thank you.
So I wanted to ask, what do you think, in light of the news that William Shatner and all these guys are wanting to go to space, do you think that that's actually important at all, or do you think it's just a pissing contest? Do you think they're doing it for the good of humanity or just themselves?
I think it's both. I think it doesn't really matter why they are doing it. I am confident that the things we will learn from developing space exploration technology will benefit humanity. Now, whether that's why Jeff Bezos is doing it and Elon Musk, or really it's just kind of, you know, just a competition among rich people, is up for debate. Could be a little bit of both, but I think that it's still going to benefit us in terms of technological development. But in terms of, like, is it important that William Shatner personally, you know, go up on the second launch? Not really. I mean, you know, I guess you could say there's more attention paid to it when prominent people are involved, but I don't really think it matters if William Shatner goes up. I mean, the tough thing about this is, all of this stuff is a combination. It's a combination of rich dudes wanting attention, fascinating technological development, what rich people do when they're not sure how to spend their money. It's all of the above. And so you can't divorce any of this stuff from the fact that, hey, you know, maybe if some of these corporations and rich people really paid the taxes that are their fair share, Maybe they wouldn't have as much money to do all this stuff, but they probably still would have enough. They wouldn't have as much, but they'd probably still have enough. And it would be the right thing to do morally in terms of making people pay their fair share. But that doesn't mean it's a bad thing that this is what they're doing. A lot of people just want to be very black and white. Like, is this good or is it bad? Very few things are so simple in life.
Yeah, I'm totally in agreement. I think it brings a lot of attention to space travel and the importance of it. But at the end of the day, I think they're kind of mainly doing it to benefit themselves and kind of get investors to throw more money at them. So,
yeah, I mean, listen, in a very, you know, to take a very kind of dark approach to it, eventually Earth will not be habitable anymore, right? The sun is going to expand and consume the Earth. So at a certain point, if humanity wants to continue, we're going to have to be able to go somewhere else. And so if the first people to start pushing us in that direction or some of the early people do it because they want fame or money, okay, I mean, that's why they do it. But at a certain point, it's something humanity would need to do.
I agree. Let's get there.
All right. Thank you. Very much appreciate the call. An important topic for sure. Let's go next to Steph from Wisconsin. Steph, you are on the air.
Hey, David. Thanks for taking the call.
Pleasure.
I have two questions.
Okay.
So the first one is, I don't know if you've seen the new data from the FDA, but they claim about the Moderna's booster. And I know that you got Moderna, so I was wondering if you were planning on getting the booster.
So, Steph, I only glanced at an article, but correct me if I'm wrong. What mm-hmm. they said is they are not really taking a position as to whether Moderna recipients should get a third shot, that mm-hmm. two shots remain effective against serious illness and death, but it's sort of up to the individual to decide.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. I haven't made a decision, to be honest, about a third shot yet.
Okay.
Yeah. I don't know. I mean, it's, I'd gladly go and get one. You know, I don't have any problem with getting a third shot. I felt pretty lousy after both my first and second shots. I would go and get one. It's just not yet clear to me that I should be the next person doing it. I don't know. I really don't know.
Yeah. It's a tough thing to decide. And so the second one, kind of in the same vein, have you seen the data suggesting that the flu shot boosts the COVID vaccine efficacy? And would you consider doing a segment on it?
I have not seen that, and I absolutely would consider doing a segment on it. If you can email some of that data to info@davidpakman.com, so the argument is you get a flu shot and it makes the COVID vaccine more efficacious.
Right. I don't want to misstate it because I haven't done like a deep dive into it. And so that's what I was just curious about. That's how I understood it.
Yeah, no, I'm finding articles. I'm finding studies mm-hmm. which say flu shot linked to less severe COVID-19. But we have, you know, there's a big correlation causation thing. We have to look more about it. You're mm-hmm. not wrong that there are such reports. I'd want to look into them more.
Okay, awesome. Yeah. I will definitely send those to the email.
All right, thanks, Steph. Appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you.
All right, Steph from Wisconsin coming in with some meaty topics. Let's take a quick break. We're going to keep taking calls, so don't go anywhere. Don't hang up if you're holding on to talk to me. We're just going to take a very, very quick break and then go right back to the phones. All right, let's keep hearing from folks in the audience via Discord. You can chat with me via voice right now at davidpakman.com/discord. We are going to go next to Marcus from Sacramento. Marcus, you're on the air.
Thanks for taking my call, Dave.
Pleasure.
So my question is in regards to Republicans moving forward on the national scale. It seems as though Republicans are able to basically push Trump's agenda without the pushback that Trump would get, because Trump was such a polarizing figure. The first person that comes to mind is like a Ron DeSantis. So I guess my overarching question is, can Republicans basically be Trump light without without the ramifications Trump would have? And secondly, who do you think gets the Republican nomination in 2024?
Second part, I have no idea. Too much still to see. We must have the 2022 results before we can really think seriously about 2024. But on your first question, the answer is absolutely yes, and it's dangerous. I've talked before about how someone like Ron DeSantis, who has all of the same kind of immoral or amoral instincts of Donald Trump, a lot of the radical ideology, but is less cartoonishly unhinged. He's still unhinged. He just less cartoonishly unhinged. He may actually be able to do a lot of the things Trump merely wanted to do but failed to do. So you are absolutely correct that the Trump agenda, to the extent that it is an agenda, and it's kind of not, right, but to the extent that it's an agenda, it would be far more likely to be carried on by people less cartoonishly problematic. And Ron DeSantis is a perfect example of such an individual.
Just one last follow-up. Do you think DeSantis has a chance in 2024?
To be the nominee or to become president?
Both.
I think to be the nominee, yes, although it depends a lot on whether Trump runs. And to become president, yeah. I mean, listen, look at the country that elected Trump in 2016. So certainly this is a country that would be ignorant enough to elect DeSantis president. Yeah, it's very, very scary.
That is scary.
Yeah.
But thank you, David.
My pleasure. Thank you for the call. Very much appreciate it. Let's go next. So many folks chatting here today. Let's go to Cooper from Colorado. Cooper, you're on the air.
Hey, David, can you hear me?
I can hear you fine, yeah.
Awesome. Huge fan of the show. I wish I had a question. I always think of some but never write them down. But just wanted to say, I think it was last week or 2 weeks ago, you had a mustache. I thought it looked excellent, sir.
Oh, thank you. Yes, I may do it again. I was asked to get rid of it before this wedding I went to over the weekend. I was told it would be really embarrassing for everybody involved for me to show up at the wedding with a mustache. But I'm gonna get it going again, I think.
Awesome. Hopefully, no shave November.
Exactly. All right. Thanks, Cooper.
Cool.
Very good. And there, Cooper has come and gone. Let's go. Where do we go next? It's tough to, after that, it's hard to know. Let's go to Andrew from Menlo Park. Andrew, you're on the air.
Hey, David. Can you hear me?
I can. You're a little low, but I'm going to bump you up. Go ahead.
Okay. I've been wanting to ask you this for a little bit. It's not really related. It's kind of related to politics, but with the kind of skyrocketing housing prices seeming not to really down very much, and first-time buyers really kind of basically being completely shut out of the market from my generation.
Yeah.
I'm a millennial. I'm 30 years old. What can the government do to kind of help with that situation? Or is buying a house just going to be a wealth generation tactic for my age who basically just inherit from their parents or just can't buy at all and they just end up being renters for life?
Lot of unknowns there. First of all, any answer, there's not one answer to your question about how the housing market, because there's multiple markets and the answers are going to be extremely regionalized. There are parts of the country where housing is still far more affordable than others. And there's still a question as to, with more remote work potentially becoming permanent, whether you're going to see a shift from folks earning okay salaries in big cities going to cheaper areas and being very well positioned to buy homes there. Of course, that will raise the value of real estate in those second or third tier areas. So all of this is a lot of moving parts. I've been reading a lot about this, and there are people who believe that these high housing prices are essentially here to stay. If that's the case, it's going to make it really difficult for a lot of young people, including people still paying off student loans, to be able to buy homes. And you can make the case that that's a really, really bad thing, particularly when for so many households, their home is the number one driver of net worth. And without that, savings and net worth are dramatically impacted. I just think there are too many unknowns. And much like with the question of like, where's the stock market going to be in 2 years or in 5 years? We are terrible at predicting this stuff. So I think anyone telling you anything definitive in answer to these questions, they're just guessing. And you should, I think we just do not yet know. And particularly with work from home, there's people who say we're going to see like a nationalization of housing markets. Of course, San Francisco is still going to cost more than Tulsa, right? But that there's going to be less of a gap. That may be the case. We may see things go in a different direction. I just think we don't yet know, but there's no question that it presents massive difficulties for people, particularly young people, paying off student loans at this time.
Well, you don't think that, as far as the question about what government can do, you think that they should just, there should be no government intervention and that maybe the market corrects itself
I'm without fine. Any kind of government? I'm fine with government involvement in affordable housing. And now, when I say affordable housing, I don't mean literally housing designated affordable housing units, but in making housing affordable. I have no moral issue with government involvement. I think that that's fine. I'm just not sure exactly what that involvement should be, because much of the idea around what that involvement should be conflicts. So I'm fine with there being a role for government. I think it could be a good thing. Maybe it's state government, maybe it's federal government, but I would want to be real clear as to what that involvement should be. And it's not exactly clear to me right now.
Okay. Thanks for, yeah, it just seems like the government's really involved on one side of the aspect of driving housing prices. They're kind of supporting current homeowners being able to stay in their houses, therefore kind of creating more, less supply, less, it just seems like they're involved in propping up the housing market rather than kind of driving prices down.
So, yeah. I mean, government's very involved in the regulation of mortgages, at least the ones governed Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac. That's another area where government's already involved. You could argue that that's not really made housing more affordable. But yeah, I have no problem with government involvement. I just want to feel good that government's being involved in a productive way.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
All right. Thank you for the call. Very much appreciate it. A lot of great questions today. Very much appreciate it. Why don't we go next to Aaron from Los Angeles? Aaron, you're on the air.
Hello, hello, David. I know you briefly mentioned this before, but I was wondering if you were ever planning on doing, I wouldn't blame you if you don't do it, but like a deep dive on misinformation in foreign communities, particularly the Latino community in the United States, because I've noticed, especially around like the Long Beach, Linwood, Downey area of LA County, that there's a lot of just misinformation and propaganda that's getting spread. And Spanish language television is definitely no assistance to that. It's usually just fear mongering on most of the major networks like Univision. So I was wondering if you know of anybody that has done studies on the effect of this type of misinformation in those communities.
I don't know of studies, and it's a very important topic. I sort of met this head on when I did, I think it was like a 12 or 14 episode election related show in Spanish on the Estrella Network, which is sort of like a competitor to Univision, but much, much smaller. They're only on in a small number of markets. And I was genuinely shocked at the reactions. And part of the confusion is, overall, the American Latino community is pretty left. I mean, Cubans are more right wing. Some Venezuelans are more right wing. But for the most part, the American Latino community is pretty left. And yet there was a ton of like vaccine disinformation and other things. I told my stories of when I was in Miami a couple months ago, and like multiple Cuban Uber and Lyft drivers were talking about becoming magnetized from the vaccine and all sorts of conspiratorial stuff. That's anecdotal, but it goes to what we're talking about here. I think it's a great topic for a deep dive. I don't know if we'll do it. Maybe we will. I don't know if we have the bandwidth right now, but it is a massive, massive issue, and it should be talked about. And, I think some people hesitate to talk about it because it feels like they're sort of like attacking Hispanic people or being xenophobic or whatever. I'm from Argentina. I'm an immigrant from Argentina. I'm part of that group culturally. It's just a reality. There's a lot of that misinformation that's spreading. And part of it, I think, is that there are not enough counterpoints that are available, which is why I tried to have a counterpoint with that short run show that I did in Spanish. But major problem. You're completely right in identifying it as it's exactly as you describe.
Yeah, I honestly don't think there is like a fair counterpoint. And even though like I do agree that many Latinos tend to be left, I feel like the culture especially, I don't know, just from my perspective as a Mexican American, is very conservative from like a religious aspect.
Yes.
And it's not even just Catholicism anymore. Like right. The evangelical movement within the Latino community has been exploding in this country. And I feel that like that's really like that is kind of another toxic thing all within itself.
Yeah. Even though voting wise, American Latinos tend to vote for Democrats, there's a lot of cultural conservatism that remains, and maybe that's part of the issue that leads to the disinformation spreading. I think you're probably onto something there.
Well, thanks, David.
My pleasure. Very important topic. Appreciate getting the opportunity to chat about it with you. Why don't we hear next from, how about Mario in Turkey? Mario, you're on the air.
Oh, hey. Hey, can you hear me fine?
Yes, I can.
Hey, I'm from the United States. I'm deployed in Turkey right now. But I was just going to say, I really don't really have a question, but I never really thought that I was going to be called on. I just want to say I've been watching you for about 5 years and member for about 5 years now. And I think you're doing absolutely wonderful work and keep it up.
Thank you. I appreciate the kind words and the support.
Yeah.
Can you tell us what are you doing in Turkey? Can you tell us anything?
I fix planes. I work planes. I'm an electrician for a KC-135.
Oh,
just
okay.
A big tanker jet. So
if it's not classified, what's like a typical electrical problem on a KC-135 that you'd have to fix?
I don't know if I can really say that. So.
Oh, wow. That even what the problems are is potentially classified.
Yeah. It's just everything that we work on. It's not like a super big deal because I mean, Turkey has these same jets, but like, I don't know for sure. So,
wow.
I just rather not, you know,
let me put it this way. Let me ask a different question. If you can answer this one. Does being a regular home electrician transfer in any way to being an electrician for airplanes as a general question?
As a general question? Yeah, I'd say I don't have any experience in that, but I mean, a ground is still a ground. And you know, if you're getting power to a component, you're still, you know, like that component should be working.
Right. Got it. And being deployed in Turkey, is your time spent like basically on a base, or are you out in the communities at all?
Oh no, yeah, I haven't been off the base since I got here, and I've been here for almost 2 months now. So they don't let us because of proximity of like the enemies in the area. They say, I don't know how true it is, but they say you know, there's like terrorists out here, and I'm sure there's probably people that don't like us, but. You know, I think from their standpoint, it's just better safe than sorry.
Wow. So you literally do not leave the base.
I haven't left the base in 2 months and they don't. Yeah, it's tough.
Will they bring in local pistachio baklava for you, or are you not even able to get that?
We have like the locals, like they have their businesses out here and on base. So it's like, but I mean, I guess I've talked to some of the locals before, and they say that their food is like Americanized so that we can, you know, it fits our palate.
I see.
And that kind of sucks, you know, because I kind of want, you know, I want to try traditional food, but yeah. It's not exactly. Yeah.
I gotcha. All right, my friend. Thank you for the call. I appreciate it.
Yeah. Thanks. Keep it up.
All right. Thank you. There is Mario from Turkey. You can get Turkish pistachio baklava on the base. Really, really important issue, which I'm glad we were able to get to the bottom of. That's going to do it for today. Thanks to everybody who called in. Apologies, I was not able to get to everybody, but we'll take calls again. We will do it again if I have anything to say about it. All right, let's get into this week's mailbag. You can write in info@davidpakman.com. I should say, after the deluge and some angry emails last week, the number of emails we get far exceeds the 5 to 10 that I can look at during the mailbag segment. We get a few hundred emails every day. Multiply that by 7 days a week. You can quickly see why we can't get to all of them. So info@davidpakman.com, but emailing is no guarantee that your email will make it into the mailbag. Let's start with today's first email. It's from Chris. Chris says, "Hey, David, hope you're well. What if Democrats or left-leaning people started up a faux right-wing party in order to steal votes from the Republicans? It might be hard to pull off the lie to make it seem authentic, but politics is a dirty game after all. If they could divert votes, then mission accomplished. If they actually win, then mission accomplished. Just something I was musing over for a bit of fun. You know, I'm not totally sure that that's legal. There was this case, actually, it's still going on. It involves Matt Gaetz in Florida, about the idea of him being involved in supporting like a sort of diversion candidate. And this is exactly the idea that Chris is pointing out. I think that there's some legal issue with it, actually, although I don't remember exactly what it is. I don't really have a moral problem with it in a sort of traditional sense, but I question whether it would really work. And at the end of the day, obviously, if it's against the law, then it shouldn't be done. But even if it's not, I'm just not sure that a fake right-wing party would really work other than maybe in a few districts. But I'd be willing to think about the logistics a little more, and maybe I'd have my mind changed on that. Kevin wrote in. Kevin says, this is a video clip that aired on CBS Morning News a month ago. The story is about the debate on requiring children to wear masks in school or not. At 2:34 into the video, a frustrated parent says to the school board, science is not fact. Science is meant to be challenged. Keep up the great work, David. Enjoy your YouTube channel. This is actually a very interesting topic. Increasingly, you hear from people on the right things like science has been wrong, and you have to be allowed to challenge science. Both of those statements are true, but you've got to challenge science with science. And contrary to, like, this is what makes science different than religious beliefs. In most organized religion, as well as in cults, you're not rewarded for challenging the orthodoxy and the teachings of the pastor, cult leader, whatever. Science, on the other hand, first of all, has a self-correcting mechanism where hopefully we can duplicate results, we do more studies, and there's also pretty big financial and fame rewards if you are able to disprove some major accepted theory in science. But you've got to do it, sorry as I hit my mic, you've got to do it with science. And so simply coming in and saying, well, I challenge the science of vaccines with my opinion that they do this or that they do that, or my pastor's feeling that they do this and that. It's absolutely true that science is meant to be challenged. The scientific method includes such a framework for those challenges, but that doesn't mean anyone's opinion is just as valid of a challenge or alternative to the accepted scientific view. So often with these people, there's like this kernel of truth, but it's completely misunderstood and misapplied. More people continue to write in about the Trump flu pandemic thing, 1917 flu, 1918 flu. As many of you know, Donald Trump started saying the 1917 flu, even though it's 1918, and he kept saying it. Some people said, oh no, he's saying 17 because 17 is the 17th letter in the alphabet. Q is the 17th letter in the alphabet. It's a signal to QAnon. AT wrote in and has a different idea and says, sir, your 1918-1917 flu analysis being a product of Trump's narcissism got me laughing. That's my theory on why Trump eats well-done steaks with ketchup. When asked, sir, how would you like it cooked? Would you like it rare, medium, well-done? Trump answered, not understanding the question, of course I want it well-done, like correctly done. And that same narcissism prevented him from sending his dry steak back. To partially remedy his predicament, he used ketchup because it was there. When asked why, he declared it's how he always eats his steak. I wish this were true, but the simpler explanation may be a burnt steak with ketchup most resembles his favorite hamburgers. Anyhow, thanks for bringing some sanity to the world. Appreciate what you do. Yeah, I think there's a lot to that. Not that this is like the most important issue, but I do think often with Trump, it's like when he started saying plasma instead of plasma. And maybe someone went to him and said, it's plasma. And he was like, no, I say plasma. Maybe nobody did. And he has no awareness that he may be saying something wrong. But I think that the narcissism is a more likely thing than it's a signal to cue. He called it the 1917 flu. Maybe someone corrected him. or he certainly must have seen it on the news, but he decided, now I call it the 1917 flu. I think that that's a very plausible scenario. Next email today is from Chris. Chris, this is very interesting. Chris says, David, I live in Texas and identify as a Republican, but frankly, I'm embarrassed to be one at this point in time. It seems a large number of Republicans currently in office don't live in reality. I believe as long as our lawmakers have the us versus them mindset, they will never come together for the good of the people. It is time for the American people to get off the couch and vote to remove these stagnant lawmakers and replace them with individuals who will put the people first. Is it time to form a common sense party? I enjoy the show and appreciate you shining a light on things no matter what side of the fence they are on. Listen, I have no problem with the idea. The idea of a common sense party has been floated many times before. To some degree, I think it's kind of what Andrew Yang is trying to do with the Forward Party. Andrew sent me his book and we're trying to get him on the show for an interview soon. But often what you end up with in these situations is that there will be some seemingly reasonable people from the right, like Chris, who might be good faith participants in such a common sense party. But very quickly you realize the vast majority of those people don't really have any common sense. And you can't really involve them because their ideas are terrible and they're not willing to have their minds changed. And so there's really no practical way that you can include them. And that's what we often end up sort of bumping up against, for lack of a better term. And so I love the idea. I would love to be able to say, hey, you know what? If we keep the left, but then we include just like the sane right, then on average, we'll have a more reasonable... We end up with very few people like Chris who we can actually include. And then what you end up risking is it appeals to more Democrats than Republicans and just hurts Democrats and leads to Republicans being elected due to it being a spoiler. And that's a disaster. That is not something I can, like, in good faith really support if it's going to even further sink the country into the bad. So send me your thoughts. I mean, is my analysis too negative, too pessimistic? Let me know. Elizabeth wrote in about Americans refusing the COVID vaccine for religious beliefs. Elizabeth says, David, hopefully you can clear this up for me. I recently saw on the news a woman who was upset because she was threatened to be removed from the kidney transplant list because she refused to get a COVID vaccine, stating religious belief. What religion would prohibit vaccination but allow an organ transplant? I believe this is just an avenue people are using to stronghold their refusal to get the COVID vaccine. Can you shed light on this? Love listening to your show. Thanks for what you do. Yeah, I don't have a specific answer, but it's a good question, which is the religions that tend to be just skeptical of medical treatment, like Christian Science is one, where I once knew someone who worked with a Christian Scientist who said, listen, if I were to like get hurt, or it was a kind of a more dangerous job, you can't just call an ambulance. You've got to call my pastor. The pastor needs to first pray for me and authorize what needs to happen, including whether the ambulance can take me or whatever. I don't know, but it would seem to me an organization like that would have as much of a problem with organ transplants as much as the vaccine, or there would be some kind of double standard. I don't actually know. Are there religions where an organ transplant is okay, but vaccination really is not okay? I'm not aware of them. My instinct is that Elizabeth is probably onto something here, and that so-called religious objections to vaccination are often just ways to try to stop conversation. It's sort of like, you know, the right likes to say, when the left doesn't like a conversation, they go, that's racist. And everybody goes, oh, and gets scared and backs away from the conversation. Similarly, I think that my religion says I can't get vaccinated could be used similarly. Here's another interesting vaccine question. This one's from Michael. Michael says, hey, David, when I hear all these anti-vax people incorrectly scream about gene therapy, what Michael's referring to is some people say the mRNA vaccines aren't vaccines, they're gene therapies. Michael says, when I hear them scream about that, I wonder, what's wrong with gene therapy? I'm not an expert on the subject, but isn't gene therapy how we would eventually cure such diseases as cancer, diabetes, and dementia, to name a few? I always thought of gene therapy as the holy grail of medicine relating to longevity. Just wanted to share that thought. Yeah, I mean, listen, I'm not an expert on that, so I shouldn't really comment specifically, but this reminds me of the vaccine makes you magnetic. It magnetizes you. Do we know for sure that being magnetized is bad? And what I mean by that is it's sort of a joke, but have the anti-vaxxers who say the vaccine magnetizes your arm or your whole body, have they said why it's bad to be magnetized? Understanding the problems with metal implants and MRIs, you know, we could imagine some reasons. But the point is, they don't really ever say that. They just say, well, it's this, and therefore it's assumed to be bad. Is it bad? If the vaccine worked via gene therapy, maybe that's okay, as long as it protects you from serious COVID and death. So very good, very good point from Mike there. And then here's a little bonus for you. This one's from YouTube. This is just wild. Someone wrote to me and they said, reread the FDA website. Idol approved for EAU, not EUA, EAU, or oh, the word for water in French. Emergency use authorized, requiring Moderna, J&J, Pfizer. You paid opposition. Remember, it's the anti-vaxxers getting paid, not the people reporting the science. But I did not know that the FDA was now, by emergency use, requiring Madonna songs be played. I find that extremely authoritarian. If people don't like Madonna, they shouldn't be forced to listen to Madonna. I think that that's absolutely horrible. Obviously, this is just riddled with misspellings. They meant Moderna by Madonna. They meant EUA rather than EAU. Oh, boy. Oh, boy. This is, you know, there's two views about something like this. One is these are obviously foreign trolls because the English is such a disaster. The other side of it is, unfortunately, there are people who write, adults who write like this in the United States. And that is a really, really sad commentary on the state of education in the United States. And I don't mean teachers are bad, but just the ability of your average person. I mean, is this considered partial illiteracy? Is this so bad that this is a sort of partial illiteracy if someone writes like this? I don't know. I don't know, but it's certainly very, very scary. You can write to me, info@davidpakman.com. Remember, just writing to me doesn't guarantee that your email will be chosen, but it is info@davidpakman.com. You can also sign up for the bonus show, an extra show every day at joinpakman.com. Sign up today.
This is Ziggy Marley, and you're listening to WRCT in Pittsburgh, you know, Go Steelers.
Are you listening in at your house? Are you listening in at your car? If you want to hear good music, you don't have to go far. 88.3 is the magic number. WRCT in the Pittsburgh area. Who say so? I say so. Who is me? Maccabee Selassie.
Hi, you're listening to
WRCT
Pittsburgh. CMU. This is Sue Garner.
And Rick Brown.
Have some barbecue sauce.
WRCT Pittsburgh, we won't respect you in the morning.
Hi, this is Kristen Hirsch. You're listening to 88.3 FM, WRCT Pittsburgh.
Arr, I'm from creationist Christopher Shin.
Arr, I'm not attractive and I'm from Steel Curtain.
Me neither, arr.
WRCT.
Pittsburgh, 88.3,
arr. Hey, this is Ben Foles, and you're listening to WRCT. It's 2 for Tuesday, 3 for Thursday, Ladies Night Wet T-Shirt Contest on 88.3 FM, biatch.
Thank you.
Nuclear Holocaust. It's a very serious problem, and one that faces all of us. Fortunately, here at WRCT Pittsburgh, we broadcast from a steel-reinforced concrete basement. So we'll be playing music long after your sorry corpse has evaporated in a blinding flash of light and heat. I hope this thought comforts you. WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM. Now and forever.
Hi, this is Felicia Collins from Late Show with David Letterman, and you are listening to WRCT Pittsburgh.
RCT Pittsburgh, meaty and full of flavor since 1949.
You're listening to WRCT Feedback Radio.
We'll give you total control over our lives. Everyone shuts the hell up.
We're Hydra! WRCT Pittsburgh!
You're listening to WRCT, friends of the FCC. Good friends, good times, and eggnog.
WRCT Pittsburgh, the last bastion of pulchritude.
Is Mark G of the Evolution Control Committee, and you're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh, where the drunken pants are going wild.
Would you like to take the sounds of your favorite radio station to places you never thought possible? Well, now you can, because WRCT is live on the internet. Just point your browser to www.wrct.org and click on our live MP3 broadcast. Now you can go out of town without any feelings of loss or regret for leaving us behind, because we're just a mouse click away. WRCT, live on the internet. Because why should Pittsburgh have all the fun?
You're tuned to WRCT Pittsburgh's automation.
Hey, this is Marlon Saunders, and you're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM.
Senator John McCain, and I'm from Arizona. But when I'm in Pittsburgh, I always listen to WRCT, one of the finest stations in all of radio, and Carnegie Mellon University is one of the finest academic institutions in our country. Be sure at your next election to vote early and vote often.
This is Brad Yoder, and you're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM.
Hi, I'm Rob.
And I'm Mary.
From high
places.
And you're listening to WRCT.
88.3 FM.
FM.
A radio station.
DJ Heim from Forest, and you're listening to 88.3 WRCT.
Sure.
Are
we still taping?
Yeah, sure. Go right ahead.
We're live. We're not taping.
Oh, we're live.
No,
okay.
We're taping.
Okay, they want me to do a little promo, and what do I do? I say WRCT, is that it?
WRCT Pittsburgh, yeah.
Okay. Right. Hello and speedy delivery. This is Mr. McFeely from Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood, and I'm in Pittsburgh. I always listen to WRCT right here in Pittsburgh. Speedy delivery to you.
Top Dog in Pittsburgh, WRCT.
From New York, this is Democracy Now!
We have a crisis here in the city of Benton Harbor, a water crisis. This water has been in a crisis longer than 3 years. They claim it's only 3 years. But the water crisis here is worse than the Flint, Michigan water crisis. They are poisoning the residents of Benton Harbor.
Officials in Michigan have warned residents in the predominantly black city of Benton Harbor to stop using tap water for drinking, cooking, or brushing their teeth due to lead contamination. The problem's been known about for years. Why is action only being taken now? We'll speak to the Reverend Edward Pinckney, the head of the Benton Harbor Community Water Council, also the pediatrician Dr. Mona Hanna-Attisha, who helped expose the water crisis in Flint, Michigan 7 years ago.
Flint's crisis was not the first, the last, or the worst. The U.S. was stubbornly slow to respect science and didn't restrict the use of lead pipes until 1986. And we don't even know, but we think there's about 9 million lead lines in the country.
Plus, we'll speak to Dr. Mona about how the COVID pandemic is impacting children. And we'll look at the escalating tension between the United States and China.
While the West and Washington are not to blame for China's actions in Xinjiang and Hong Kong, when you have this overwhelmingly unified nationalist message that Washington is embracing around confronting China, this reinforces the same chauvinistic nationalist forces in China itself.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Mimi Goodman. West Virginia Senator Joe Manchin continues to thwart Democrats' attempts to pass an historic 10-year reconciliation package that would vastly expand the social safety net and combat the climate crisis. Manchin told the White House he opposes a key provision to replace coal and gas-fired power plants with renewable energy sources, a central pillar of the Build Back Better Act's climate plans. Senator Manchin's received more campaign donations from the oil, coal, and gas industries than any other senator. He's also earned millions from coal companies he created in the 1980s that his son now runs. As Manchin fights plans to curb the worst effects of the climate crisis, recently released data show his home state of West Virginia is more vulnerable to worsening floods than anywhere else in the United States. This comes as indigenous leaders and climate activists capped off a week-long protest in Washington, D.C. Friday with a march on the U.S. Capitol and a sit-in on Pennsylvania Avenue. They called again on President Biden to declare a climate emergency. Over 90 activists were arrested, bringing the total number of arrests during the week of action to 655. In more news about the stalled reconciliation package, Axios is reporting Senator Joe Manchin told the White House the plan's child tax credit must include a firm work requirement and an income cap around $60,000 per family. The expanded credit, which was passed in March in the American Rescue Plan, has lifted millions of American children out of poverty. Studies show extending the credit beyond 2021 would cut child poverty even further, reducing it another 40%. On Friday, Biden touted the Build Back Better Act's provisions for working families while visiting a child care center in Connecticut.
How can we compete in a world of millions of Americans' parents, especially moms, can't be part of the workforce because they can't afford the cost of child care or elder care, I might add. Elder care.
A Food and Drug Administration advisory panel unanimously approved booster shots for the one-shot Johnson & Johnson vaccine Friday. The second shot can be given as early as 2 months after the first dose. Federal regulators will now meet to decide whether to greenlight the panel's recent recommendations on J&J and Moderna boosters, as well as whether people should mix and match vaccines.